Hey, welcome to the Wenner Folsom podcast, your source for battle-tested leadership and resiliency. I have a really, really cool guest. I've been looking forward to chatting it up with this beautiful man today. So we got a great show.
Yeah, really excited to be here with Pat, who's also in men's work and has been in men's work. And we're going to be able to dive into some fun topics today around men's work and even doing, he's done a lot of the work around trauma. And now we're going to probably talk about even initiation and some basic premise of men's work, movement, breath work, and how to really elevate as a man. So it'll be a fun conversation. So really grateful to have you here, Pat, and to be jumping on this conversation.
Yeah, thank you, boys. It's good to get to connect in this way and have a lot of appreciation for you both and everything you're bringing to the world. So thank you.
So what's under the little pump cover, Pat?
I've been looking after my health a bit more recently.
Yeah, you have.
You know, it was funny. I was watching Stutz. I don't know if you guys saw that documentary with Jonah Hill and his therapist.
Yeah. String of Pearls.
Really good. He talked early on about this idea of life force. And his therapist was saying, like, when you're in doubt, come back to the basics and just look after nutrition and social connection and exercise. And I think I recognize that sometimes I get lost in the work. I love the trauma work. I love the archetypal work. That's what drew me to you guys. But there's also a lot to be said for just getting in and throwing some weight around and eating well. And it's definitely been an impact in terms of my confidence, my energy. And yeah, it feels good to be back on track.
It seems to be the place where almost all the super successful men that I know go to that house first. It's shoring up the warrior house. It means it's either boundaries, power, results, fitness. Like there is something that is warrior centric in the foundation for masculinity. And I think that that goes back to probably some of the core values that all cultures ascribe to as being a successful man. And Jack Donovan talks about that when he talks about what does it mean to be not just a good man, but good at being a man. And strength and power is just universal in that conversation, however you define those things.
I also think a lot of it is structure. Part of the masculine is to create structure. Part of the masculine is to create foundation. So us being able to create a really healthy foundation from what we put in our bodies, how we fuel our bodies, how we live our day, and how we train the body, we actually are training for more capacity, to take on more capacity. And really interesting thought too, when we talk about the trauma work, which we can get to in a minute though, we're also creating containers for us to be in that feminine expression, which is a lot of the messy emotions and shit you have to offload off the body. Without a safe container to do that, I think that's where a lot of the problems are. Without creating safety in a container to express that is when it becomes detrimental in society. So, but a safe container, you can have the foundation to build whatever you want and to support whatever you want, including self-regulation, which we could dive in here in a little bit.
Actually, I started in the fitness industry when I was 18, 19, and that was where I started in business and grew a successful fitness business, but drifted away from it. But one of the things that drew me to fitness early on was that old expression. It's like a self-development expression that you can't pay someone else to do your push-ups for you. And I like that idea that it doesn't matter how much money you have in the bank. It doesn't matter how much status you've got. Your health is to a certain degree within your control. You know, obviously there's variations in terms of what people are dealing with, but there's lots of areas in my life I can control, but finding that certainty in the gym has definitely been something that's made me more grounded and confident. And yeah, you can't pay anyone to do your pushups for you.
We just got off Josh and I were on a coaching call before this with some of our Black Horse guys. That's our executive coaching group. And one of the things that came up was when we look at our lives are evidence of our efficacy. It's the test of our philosophy, our protocol, our standards, like the full scope of the game we bring to life currently. And the fitness component is one of those. Yeah, you can't deny that. There's no way you can hide it. Like you said, pay somebody to do it. Like you either built your abs in the kitchen out of discipline and you built your body with weights. It's irrefutable efficacy of, do you have those skill sets to do that?
It's interesting enough too. One of the guys in our community mentioned he was researching like millionaire status and how to become it. And it's actually harder to get abs than it is to become a millionaire by just research and studies of statistics. So it shows like it's not easy. And I know personally, I mean, just different body types. I've only had it once when I was cutting for my show, and it's really hard to get and maintain unless you have certain body types and genetics. So started in fitness, what bridged the gap to get into men's work? Like what put you, because you've been in men's work now for a while, what bridged that gap for you? Especially in Ireland, where you're based in Ireland, where it's not the status quo. So you had to go against the grain to really push that initiative forward.
Yeah, I guess it's been a unique journey in the sense that I started in fitness and failed pretty miserably with my first business and came back to my hometown at 24 and went through my dark night of the soul. And my, you know, I was only 24, but at the time I had such amount of shame around the fact that I had failed and had to come back to living with my parents. And I really fell into a depression, but I started again back in Galway. So I live in the west coast of Ireland and I started teaching fitness classes on my local beach. So it's not the romantic notion of California where it's sunny, it's piss and rain every day. But I built a community and I built a culture that just changed everything for me and for my community. Within 3 months of starting these classes, I had 100 people. And within a year, I had 500 people coming to the beach. And over 4 years, we went to 20,000 clients online. So that was the fitness component. And I think it ran its course for me. I did what I wanted to do in that space and stepped out when it was at its peak. And then in my own personal life, I think I had always pointed to success as being the answer to my lack of confidence. And when I achieved everything I ever wanted and still felt empty, that prompted me to go into the work. And I transitioned slowly into personal development work, meditation, breath work, all these different modalities. And at first, my fitness clientele were female. And so most of the people coming to my seminars were female. And if there was any guys there, I'd always ask, did your wife drag you along? And they'd say, yeah. But over the years, the demographic just shifted and 50-50, you know, half the guys in the room, half women in the room. And I just saw like, this needs to happen. This is something that's people are crying out for. Suicide rates are epidemic here. I've lost friends to suicide, like most of us. And I tend to build what I need. So I have always needed community. And so I build communities. And I also have learned over time that my wound, I think Elliot Holt says, my wound is my womb. And my wound was always not trusting men, not feeling like I fit in. And so I'm doing the work of giving myself what I need now, what I've always needed, and doing my best to lead the way, I suppose, in Ireland, or be one of the leaders at least. And again, I look to you guys for inspiration. And I also value doing it my own way. I have lots of interests like jiu-jitsu and hiking and climbing mountains. And I try to bring all those elements to it and just make it accessible to guys like my dad that would never otherwise come to this kind of work. I feel like my hero's journey was going for 10 years and sitting in rooms where I was the only guy in the room. Josh, you probably had it with Gabor Mate's training. The guys in there were few and far between. And then I'm coming back with the gold of here's the tools I've picked up. So yeah, that's my angle.
Profound. And yeah, Gabor, that training is one of the best I've found. It's like clinical level, but it's his like basic introduction. It's their basic introduction course, but it's really, really well done. So that's powerful. I'm glad you also did that.
I remember that they said early on, this is going to be a triggering year. And I thought, I've done plant medicine. I've been through the triggers. 2 months in, I was like, oh, make it stop.
I actually found it really freeing. I have disassociated memories. So I don't have almost any memories from when I'm young. And so all the way through high school. So for me, it was helpful to go back and actually get into the body and then start to have all these memories come up. So for me, it was actually really healing to like have memories from childhood and memories from my youth. And also to make it through the armor I learned, and this is true with most men. So I'm bringing this up in this conversation. A lot of men struggle with feeling in general, which was me and still is at times. And it's because this armor sets in, or the freeze response is how I see it, is that freeze response is so thick that you literally can't feel anything because the body goes dumb. And I learned that is a feeling. So it was a huge epiphany because I'd run retreats for years where guys would be like, I can't feel. They would do somatic work and get into the body, but then when we were out talking, they couldn't feel. And the numbness, if you're feeling numbness, that is a feeling. So that was really powerful. There's a lot of work to go in and be with that numbness, but it's the armor protecting you from all the waves of feeling underneath that. But it starts with feeling the numbness or the top layer of armor.
Can we dig into this one a little bit? Because I think it's really important. And Pat, a lot of our viewers and listeners are warrior class men. And some women, which means first responders, police, fire, veterans, communities. And Josh, you're talking about the armor, men armor up. But it's important to realize why we armor up. And we armor up so that we can follow protocol to conduct missions that most people cannot do. That's why you put on the armor. because you're doing things that are inherently traumatic. So I think there's a tendency in a lot of our work, men's work, is to dismiss the armor as wrong. It's a dismissal of masculinity. And the core premise of masculinity is that we do hard shit. That's what men are built to do, what our bodies are built to do. And the fact that we have the capacity to turn off emotions in order to do traumatic missions, we're built for that as well. I think that it's important to at least acknowledge the function of that and then realize we need to really explore the reintegration process, right? Because there's a lot of men who feel really rejected about that we're bad or we're wrong because we're wearing this armor. And I think part of that was like, not, there used to be a sense of pride that you were capable of wearing the armor. And now that's dismissed. So I think maybe the important part for at least people of my psychological and historical background is, how do I honor the importance of what I'm capable of doing and have done, but then find a way to reintegrate so that I can live a life of feelings and compassion and actually feeling joy and enjoying sunsets and all those things, which I struggle with. I struggle with looking at a sunset and everybody else is ooing and awing. And I'm kind of like, yeah, that happens every night. So what's next? Like bringing us back and recognizing that we're going to go back out there again. You're putting the armor back on. It's not like this, it's this toxic bad thing that has been welded onto us. And oh, I finally let go of my armor. Like, oh no, Monday morning, almost all of you fucking men are putting the armor back on to go to war. So that's the bigger question, is how do we honor, and Josh used the word, you know, clearing the tanks, removing the debris. How do we do that and then still go back and do the horrific shit that a lot of men do, even working in a cubicle? Talk about the armor that's required to go sit in a cubicle and do something you don't want to do in support of your family. That was my little rant. Thanks, guys.
couple of thoughts. One piece I often think about is the idea that we all mature biologically, but we get stuck psychologically in difficult moments. And so for a lot of us men, we were taught that anger was safe to show, because if I showed my anger, you'd stay away from me. But for me, at least in Ireland, if I showed my joy, or if I showed flamboyance, or if I showed creativity or sadness or any other emotion, that was not safe to show. And so, of course, psychologically, we come up with strategies to keep ourselves safe. The safety officer comes in, says, right, I'm going to be the tough guy now. Okay, I'm going to be the people pleaser. I'm going to keep people at arm's length. But I think also there's an armoring within the body. So psychologically, I come up with strategies to stay safe. Biologically or physiologically, I come up with armoring and I tense down and I hold that in my body. The idea that my tissue stores my issues. I think the very practical piece in terms of how do we start to do this, the first is recognizing that we get better at the things that we practice in life. So if I'm very practiced at armoring, I'm probably very good at being armored. And I think we have to be compassionate with ourselves and find a space for a practice and be patient with the practice. So the practice could be 10 minutes of Wim Hof breathing, and that helps you to become more aware of the sensations in your body. It could be jiu-jitsu mats. It could be anything that you can find that brings you more into the body, I think is a useful tool. I think one of the pitfalls for a lot of people is they hear about meditation and the benefits and they think, I need to meditate. But I was always prompt people to ask, what is meditation? What are you hoping it's going to give you? And are there other ways of getting that same result? Because different strokes for different folks. But I think it's a practice. I think it's being slow and measured. I also like the idea of pendulation. So if we shake up a bottle of Coke and we try to open it up real quick, it's going to go everywhere. And so you open it a little bit and then you close it back down. And then you open a little more, you take the fizz out of it. And similar with our trauma work. It's important that we're resourced. It's important we have people to turn to. We have our men's group. We have our health practices. We've got the gym or whatever it is that keeps us grounded. And these wounds didn't happen overnight. And so we don't need to heal them overnight, but we need to consciously choose. I think I need to consciously choose to make space for my feeling. We see it in the wild with animals, right? They have a stress response. And once they get to safety, they'll scan the environment and they'll look around, they'll orientate, am I safe? And if they're safe, they fall to their side, they shake out the stress, and then they get back up. So similar for ourselves, if we're always in hypervigilance, if we're always meeting high demand and always having high expectations on ourselves, it's difficult to let go. And so maybe it's a case of take one day in the month where I go to the mountains and I shout and I scream and I cry and I whatever else, and then come back to my life. Slow and steady, I think, is one of the answers.
Yeah, I love what you brought up, Philip, and I loved your follow-up, Pat. I think it is really important to note. One of the things we talked about in K4 is like, how can you be adaptable? And so it's not right or wrong. It's not black or white. It's actually like, what do I need for what situation? And so I'd say some men actually need to put some armor on to actually go make their life happen. And they are struggling not getting armored up to go out into the world to face hard challenges or to deal with discomfort or to deal with failure or to deal with some of the things that it takes as a man in the world. You're going to fail. You're going to get knocked down. You're going to get beat up. And it takes some armor to move through that. So it's like, which situation do you need it? I think in general, for me, I guess just speaking more directly, I thought that armor was the one way I managed life. And I thought I was resilient if I didn't feel any emotion through anything. And so I think the broader conversation is, if you use that and if you can't feel your body, you lose access to your compass. And so if I can't feel my heart because I've got so much armor on that I've suppressed so much feeling to be on mission, then what's great is, yeah, I can go through any challenge and get back up and keep charging, but I lose access to my heart, which means I've lost my compass. So I would loop the same fucking pattern over and over and over. I'd attract the same people out of Drew. I would attract the same patterns because I couldn't feel, is it safe or not safe? I couldn't tell, is this a good person or bad person? I couldn't discern because I lost access to the heart. So I think the combination of the two is that's all valuable, but you need to have a sacred container or a safe space to offload and start to practice getting into that. And it's a practice. But what I'm finding is allowing myself to go through from head to heart, to go through that mess, to get into some of that chaotic offloading, which we talk about with the Spartans and the samurai and every other ancient warrior culture had practices, creating a safe place to do that, you get back into your heart again. And when you're back in your heart, you can feel like, ah, here's what I need. And that's what we typically, one metaphor I like to use is, we typically bring the war back to our families. So if we don't make time to offload, then that armor we got on in the battle, we actually bring that into our households and we're creating havoc in the household. Unless we can say, hey, let me stop, offload, let me come home now and open my heart. Or can I do that with myself? If I'm not getting results in my relationship or my health or my business, I'm going to have to go through that uncomfortability to face what's not working. And I'm going to have to go into the wound and be with some of those messy emotions if I actually want to course correct. Otherwise, I'm going to keep looping the same thing like I did for a couple of decades. So I could just tell you, it doesn't work from my perspective, just having armor as the tool set. But I liked your reframe on it is, it's hard to do and it is part of masculinity, but it's one piece. It feels like we're stretching. What does it mean to be a man now? And what do we get to have if we want it? And how do we create it?
I want to add one piece on this. The thing that really provided me the perspective or the judo, the sweep, Pat, to get traction on why I deserved to go through the healing journey, which I'm still in, was that I'm abdicating my duties as a man if I don't. And that sense of honor is louder than anything else for me. I will always do more for others than I will do for myself. And I know that if I don't address some of these issues, then I pass that ancestral curse on to my children. And that's untenable for me. In addition to that, if I'm not able to understand and partner with other people and forgive other people and be compassionate and patient, then ultimately I will be unsuccessful as well. So I have just failed at my primary mission, which is achieving results that serve something larger than myself. And I even fail at fucking that if I don't take care of myself. So I had to actually come full circle to realize that all of this stuff is actually practically and tactically just undeniable. I have to do it if I'm going to be successful. And that was eventually where I had to go to give myself permission to do that, because it felt selfish to me.
I was in an ayahuasca retreat a couple of years ago, and all of my stuff came up, all of my memories of loneliness and not fitting in and the fear that I lived with. And ultimately what it brought me to was the competitive nature that I was living in and how I needed to get ahead, that life was a competition, that I needed to win. And that meant I couldn't trust other people because they were my competitors. And so I cried for hours And the following year, I was back there and I went into a similar loop and I was crying. And the shaman came to me and she just looked at me and I thought she was going to comfort me. And she said, when are you going to stop being a victim? And it stopped me in my tracks. But she said to me, the victim in you keeps the victim in your audience alive. So she said, if you stand on a stage and you're playing the victim, and it was powerful. Ouch. She said, who benefits in your life when you play the victim? And I had to think about it. And I said, well, the people around me that don't want to step up. She said, so are you helping them or are you just feeding the victim in them? She said, what if you showed up as a healthy, sovereign being? What would happen? What would happen in the people in front of you? They'd show up in their healthy sovereignty.
And did you cry again, Pat?
I cried for another 3 hours. And then I had a dance and I went to the fire.
Yeah, good, Pat. What a gift.
But you know, the bigger piece actually in that was from a practical sense, coming back to your piece, Phil, was I recognized that if I'm going to cry for my wounds, I could sit down and never get back up. And so I'm not going to do that because I've got a life to live. But equally, I'm not going to ignore the times where I do need to cry. So I think, again, it comes back to containment. And maybe that's my masculine essence can take 15 minutes in the day for breath work, or I can take 15 minutes for expressive writing. Or I guess it's just coming back to the archetypes, a chance to practice being in my lover, because that's my big mantra, is I get better at what I practice. And so for the man who's a warrior all his life, you haven't had a practice of being in your lover. So allow yourself to practice. So Ed Sheeran had a quote once where they asked him, how do you write pop songs or how do you write successful songs? And he said, it's like turning on a dirty old tap that hasn't been used. You turn it on and it spits a lot of dirty water. But he said, if you keep it going, you keep writing, eventually the good stuff comes. Mm. I think it's similar with anything we practice. And our ego hates being in that messy middle where you become aware how little you know. But if you stick with it, I think you can develop all your archetypes. You can develop any strength.
Hey, I just want to point out one thing that you just said. And this is brilliant, by the way. I got a little bit of a slap in the face, which I needed. I'm always down for a slap in the face by that same story. I can take some more medicine there personally. So thank you for that. And then second, this is just something I've been realizing, because I do a lot of these, and I know you do similar work, Pat, where create safe spaces for people to actually get into grief and messy emotions. But doing it as my own practice has still been hard. I still struggle with that. I do it, but I struggle with some of my own beliefs around it. And one of my good buddies, John Weiland, had said, hey, the masculine needs to create a safe space to be in feminine expression. And I realized, hey, we all have masculine, feminine aspects of us. And that was really helpful for me. And I'm seeing this also landing now of like, oh, the masculine part of me creates a really safe container that I feel safe to go into. And then I'm allowed to get into a messy place where I can feel sadness. I can feel grief. I can feel anger. We're containing the anger. We're containing the sadness, but we're giving that expression, which expression is feminine. Masculine is not expressive.
Can I challenge this?
Sure.
Both y'all. I know I'm outnumbered here.
Challenge.
This is the fucking problem. Why are you labeling emotions as feminine? Like, of course men don't want to fucking do that. You're saying it's feminine. I don't understand why we're saying that emotions or messiness is feminine.
Good point. What would you characterize it in a framework so we can relate?
It's emotional and messy. Like, okay, I don't think lover house, you're saying lover house is feminine. I disagree. I don't want to have my lover house is being construed as my feminine house. Why? What is the point of that?
Wouldn't Jung have talked about individuation being about like the masculine integrating the feminine aspects, the feminine integrating the masculine? And I would just see it as terminology, but
I agree. There's a terminology, but it's a tricky thing when you're saying that there are certain aspects of humanity. And I do agree that the moon would be feminine. The ocean is feminine. Mountains are masculine. Yeah, I totally get that, you know, the semantics of that. Hmm. But when you're getting into practical pieces, which are saying emotions are feminine, and you're wondering why men are having a hard time doing that, that is a relevant topic, I believe.
Hey, we thank you for listening to the Winter Folsom podcast. Just a couple quick notes. First, if you are a man and you're looking for an honorable and inspiring group of men to hold you accountable and challenge you to grow in your relationships, your fitness, your career, your finances, and your life, go to www.k4men.com. And if you are a veteran, first responder, or man or woman who deals with trauma, and you are looking for some resiliency tools and skills for you, your team, or your organization, go to valorresiliency.com. Hope to see you there. Back to the podcast. I think it's exactly what you're saying. When you're saying ocean is movement, it's movement. Movement is more of a, whatever you would call that, feminine, because they do talk about there's certain earth, like earth and water, they're different elements. One is very structurally sound. One creates movement. It's the yin and the yang. So however you describe the contrast of masculine container for something to be uncontained. So whatever the language would be for you to feel, it's the same thing with nourishing, I'm finding. And again, I guess the language, I demonized a part of myself that took care of myself, nourished myself, felt any type of emotion. So to me, it helps sense to go, oh, these are all things that characterize around feminine energy that I demonized myself or I destroyed in myself. So I could never access those, but maybe there's a different word to say.
Yeah,
how would you summarize, how would you summarize all of those?
I think it's the vulnerable part of men. It's men reclaiming their vulnerability or their emotional capacity. But the moment we say that's feminine, it's always been off-putting for me, for the men's movement, which we're all part of here, is that getting in touch with your feminine. Like, now I don't have a feminine. I'm a man and I have emotional aspects of myself and vulnerable aspects. And I also need to be taken care of and I need to be flamboyant. Those are inherently masculine. But to dismiss them as feminine, and maybe even dismiss is not the right word, to label them as feminine. The men's movement, the fact that there's such a labeling of that term, it's always been kind of off-putting for me. And I think it's off-putting for a lot of men to go into any sort of workshop where you're being encouraged to become feminine. Like, no, I want to be a more compassionate version of a man. I don't want to become a woman or feminine.
I love this. I think it's a great subject. And I think you're onto something. And I think we were talking about frameworks that people are bringing forth to study, but I think it makes sense. That's probably why most of the men, to Pat, our conversation earlier, guys in masculine feminine workshops are typically not the traditional warrior type men, right? They're typically the woke side, or they're typically guys in their spirituality, or it's a different type of man that you get in a lot of those workshops that are learning what they would say is emotional intelligence, masculine, feminine polarity. A lot of these concepts or frameworks, Philip, maybe that same topic of, oh, it's all framed wrong, right? Or framed in a way that's not landing or being received by a whole wave of men's work or men.
I guess we could label it, you know, structure and flow, being and doing. For me, with my audience who are kind of your everyday guys that have probably never read a book on masculinity or personal development, the archetypes just works really well, because I think they recognize, okay, lover relates to my connection to myself and others and nature. Okay, warrior relates to my boundaries and my action. That's probably as far as it needs to go with those guys. And yeah, he's a language piece.
I teach the archetypes to corporate organizations. Like, I'm a corporate leadership guy. And when I slide into that lover house, I just can feel all the men in the room just being repelled by just that term. So I intentionally have, you know, kind of create a little on-ramp of how powerful the lover house is, and that it actually rules the majority of the big profit drivers that make money and get results, engagement and retention and resiliency. Like, those are all power words that live in that lover house. And I'm very careful not to make it feminine, to label the lover house as being feminine. It is a really important topic with everybody who's outside of the men's movement that is fairly comfortable with that, those polarity terms.
I think it's a good dialogue, and it actually boils up is there's a resistance in masculinity to being. And I think a lot of it comes from what we're typically told our value and our worth is from doing, which from us in the archetypes would be warrior, king, and magician are doing, lovers being. So I think it's the same conversation, but it's a really valid conversation. Is, I think all of us, including myself, right? Like, we're all, I have to continually work on leaning into that house. So it is interesting. Is it cultural conditioning? Is it labeling? Like, where is that resistance? Is it inherently resistant to men and masculinity? No, so
same thing. Women do not want to be masculine. I mean, that's a terrible word in the women's movement, is to become a masculine woman. And again, the connotations of that are that they're powerful, they're willful, they're ambitious, like the assertive. As soon as they are those things, now they all of a sudden they're masculine. And I think that's incorrect. It's terrible. I have a daughter, Pat. So I mean, like, I want her to be assertive and ambitious and even, dare I say, dominant. Like, I want her to be those things without having to be masculine.
How do you feel about anima and animus, going back to Jung? So if Carl Jung said that we have this split, we've got our shadow, we've got who we think we are, we've got our inner anima, inner
genius animus. And Juno.
Same idea?
Yeah.
Same thing?
Yeah.
I like being and doing. I think the easier label of that can summarize the archetypes. So maybe we get to, maybe this gets to come forth of a new framework or language around, that's really what we're talking about. How do you step into being, which is the now, which is the present moment, which is emotion, which is all the things that are now, versus doing is all the other houses. So interesting.
Maybe the bigger piece is coming back to K4's piece in terms of the three-legged horse. And I know for me, when I achieved and ticked all the boxes that my head had set out to achieve and I didn't feel fulfilled, there was a missing horse, or there was a missing leg on the horse. And that was what drove me to starting to listen to my feelings and listen to my body, because logically everything in my life was as it should be. But I was sort of ignoring what I was feeling, ignoring my anxieties, ignoring my need to grieve, you know, so many pieces. And I liken it to, in Ireland, I'm sure maybe it was the same in the States, but in Ireland growing up, we didn't have time to feel. You shouldn't feel that way. You should be grateful. You should be happy. You should appreciate what you have. Mm. And I think oftentimes that messaging leads to us having the same internal messaging when our emotions come up. So when my anxiety comes up, the voice in my head says, you should be grateful. And the problem with that is anxiety is a collection of sensations in my body that are pointing me towards something. But when I go to my head, I escape my body. I leave my body. That's, I think, where the issue is. It's learning to come back into the body and just give a bit of space. I think Gabor says, where there is tension requires attention. So that might be a few deep breaths. It might be closing the eyes and asking that part of the body what's going on. I think that's the bigger piece. I stayed with a girl in New York a couple of years ago who was a yogi, and I had only met her for 10 minutes at a conference. And she said, if you're in New York, come and hang out. Mm. So I stayed with her for 10 days, and every day she'd say, Pat, how do you feel? And I'd say, I feel good. And she'd say, good is not a feeling. I'd say, I feel fine. She said, fine is also not a feeling. How do you feel? I feel grand. And she said, what the fuck is wrong with you? And
I'm feeling frustrated at your question. That's a feeling.
But I asked her a week in, I said, you know, I was half joking. I said, how do you feel? And she put her hands on her heart. She said, I'm excited and I'm grateful. And I thought she was crazy. And then I came home and I said, maybe I'm crazy that I have no concept as to how I feel unless I'm about to have a panic attack. And what it made me think is, if you don't know what you feel, you can't know what you need, because your feelings are always pointing to unmet needs. So the feeling of anxiety points to a need for
that's the compass, or certainty. You're talking about.
True.
Super cool. Yeah.
So I just got into the habit of a simple practice, I think daily, coming back to the kind of practical piece of this is, I have a resource that's a wheel of emotions. You'll find them easily online, and it helps us to develop a bit of an emotional literacy. So you look at the wheel, you say, okay, what am I experiencing today? And you try to get as clear as you can. And your language might be very simple at first. You can say you're happy or you're sad or you're anxious, but over time you say, okay, I'm agitated, I'm frustrated, I'm hopeful, I'm joyful. And based on the feeling that you're experiencing, you might ask, what is it that I need? Because again, the feeling often points to a need. It's the same as frustrations we have with others generally are unmet needs. So I might say, you always make me feel a certain way. I could say, I need you to show up more consistently. I think an awareness of our feelings and needs is a key piece in our development, for me at least. I should
speak. Emotional literacy. What a good term, Pat.
I like that a lot.
That's a really good one. I think most people we're emotionally illiterate.
Yeah, I think Brené Brown says we have 3 to 5, maybe on average. 3, I think she says, emotions that we're able to name, most of us. And
you mean feel or to feel and then name?
I think the difference is, I could be off on this, and again, a language piece, but I think the feelings will be a couple of select feelings, and then the emotions are oftentimes different expressions. So if the feeling is anger, the emotion or the label I might give it is, you know, frustration, agitation, anger, resentment, aggression, rage. But generally the feeling is, again, a collection. This is a teacher shared with me a couple of years ago, and he said, we have these collection of sensations in our body. So tightness in my chest, flush in my face, I feel a fast pace in my system, and I say, I'm anxious. And as soon as I say, I'm anxious, I jump to my head and I start thinking, why am I anxious? And I start building stories and I go from my body to my head. And maybe all that needs to happen is I need to close my eyes and say, what's going on here? And I say, okay, there's tightness in my chest. There's a fast heart rate. Okay, what's happening now? And keep my breath moving. If I can keep my breath moving, generally that will ease.
Those feelings that head labels as anxiety could also be excitement, which is a very different story. So how much is choice involved in the creation of your emotional state?
To me, this is the work.
It's an honest question.
I love the question because the question is, if a man is so focused on frontward or whoever is so focused on the mission that they're not doing the work to start to get curious, there's something in the brain called non-conscious rapid emotion bias. And as little children, if XYZ happens, the brain links up this quick set of emotion that happens in a third of a second means X. It's a bias. So we live our life through the brain's reactions of bias that are very reactive to keep us safe and to survive.
That's the physical sensations you're talking about.
It happens in a third of a second, and then we feel after it's already been decided. So we're actually, the brain's making a judgment before we actually feel anything, and we actually even feel the sensation. So if we're not doing work to go in, as Pat's describing, and feel, become emotionally literate, feel what's actually happening in the body, once we're able to start to feel it, then you can start to rewire what's actually happening in the body, because then you can start to question and go, oh, wait, I'm okay now. I am safe. I'm actually excited. Or what are my needs? Oh, I just need to get X, Y, Z. And then if you could start to get those needs met, it starts to change the actual programming from just an automatic story head response to actually you start to rewrite the story and build new neural pathways. This is the work of why we go in, because this would be an exact example of, oh, this is safe. Go down the same path we've been that creates the same havoc that we get to experience again and again. Right? It's what leads us to those same, if we're not reinvestigating those.
And it was an interesting example you gave, Philip, because you may know the quote, but Fritz Perl, who was the founder of Gestalt therapy, had a quote that said, anxiety is excitement without the breath. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of points to maybe anxiety. If I'm experiencing anxiety and I lean away from it and I try to push it away and avoid it, there's tension and there's resistance. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I take the breath and I lean in and I be with that emotion and give it some space and give it some, make it bigger, maybe then it's excitement. So is it the difference between leaning in versus, I talk about checking in or checking out. So checking in is, I feel anxious, what do I need? Checking out is unconsciously having that anxiety and reaching for a bottle of beer to help numb myself. So that was my experience, at least in my 20s, was difficult feeling emerges. I don't like these sensations. I'm going to numb myself in some way. Porn, alcohol, whatever it might be. And it's a very simple shift, not easy, but simple shift to get into the practice of saying, wait a second, what do I feel? What do I need? How can I meet that need in a healthy way? This is a little bit out there, but I had a mentor years ago and he said that maybe the reason people smoke when they want to stop smoking is that when someone smokes, number one, they step away from their stressful environment. So they step out of the office so they get into safety. Two, it might be the only time of the day they take a nice deep breath. Mm-hmm. Three, they're connected with other like-minded people in the smoking area. So they're getting their needs for connection, for a deep breath and a change of environment. So by that logic, I think about back to the mind-body connection. When we're stressed or we're overwhelmed or we're experiencing trauma or whatever language you want to put on it, the body is sensing lots of signs of danger. And our way of finding ease is to look for signs of safety. And so again, if we don't have the emotional literacy to check in with what I'm experiencing in my body, we're almost denying the fact that the system is picking up on signs of danger.
I love your language. It's great. And
it's a good little challenge, Josh. I think Pat's dancing around the challenge.
I agree.
With it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, we always give a challenge to listeners. So it feels like this is the challenge that would be a good challenge. Now take this and implement it if you're listening.
Oh, can I share I have a framework, if you will. And maybe I can marry this in with something I've heard Philip talk about with the warriors and the reintegration process. I've heard you talk about, Philip, when the warriors came back from war, there was, you'll explain this better than me, but there was a process of saying, okay, the battle has been fought. Now it's time to come back and be human. And so there'd be a process for that. On our day-to-day lives, we might consider the same, that we've come back from the office or we've come back from whatever our workplace is. And as you say, Joshua, we don't want to bring the war home with us. So it could be that when we're in the car, before we step into home, we have a ritual of, I call it ABCD as a bit of an acronym. So A is acknowledge how I feel. So just check in, how do I feel? B is take a couple of breaths. So whatever you feel, you just breathe into it. Okay. Nice deep breaths create that sense of safety. It's just the feeling. It's not going to do anything to you. So just breathing into it. So acknowledge how I feel, breathe into it. C is choose how I'd like to feel. So if I feel anxious, take a couple of breaths, choose how I'd like to feel. I'd like to feel calm. And then D is decide, what's one action I can take to move me in that direction? It's not about clicking your fingers and make everything perfect. But I know I've had days where I start telling myself a story about how I feel, and I just get caught in that all day. So it's like pressing the stop button and saying, I'm going to change the direction here of my day. So A, B, C, D, acknowledge, breathe, choose, decide.
Well done. Those are your marching orders, people.
And hey, it's been so fun chatting with you, Pat. How can people get a hold of you? You have any projects coming up that you'd like to share that you'd like people to know about in our audience?
Thank you again, guys. I love what you're doing. And I love the two worlds that you bring together between the archetypal stuff and the leadership and the resilience and trauma. And I love it. PatTivoli.com is my website. So I lead donation-based breathwork classes and got a podcast and a bunch of things going on. So you're very welcome to reach out if anyone needs any support.
Awesome. Hey, it's been such a pleasure having you on, Pat. And for all of our listeners, remember, stay battle-tested.